Good evening, and welcome to the New York Society Library. We're pleased to see you all here on this rainy evening. I'm Sarah Holliday, Library Events Coordinator, and I'm only standing up here to welcome you and to ask you please to silence cell phones or anything that might make a noise and disrupt the event this evening. To introduce our speaker, we have our trustee, Timothy N. Wallach, who first recommended this book to us. So it's my pleasure to introduce Tim Wallach, who will introduce Lee Billings.
Good. So good evening, and I'm Tim Wallach. I'm a trustee of the library, and I welcome you to the talk by Lee Billings on his fine book, 5 Billion Years of Solitude, The Search for Life Among the Stars. Sarah, did you give the notice? First I need to correct Sarah on something. With regard to our cell phones and smartphones, we should keep them on during this lecture, just in case something out there is trying to contact us. So you remember the movie Annie Hall, where young Woody Allen's mother accompanies him to a psychiatrist because 10-year-old Woody is deeply depressed and bemoans, "The universe is everything, and it's expanding. Someday it will break apart, and that would be the end of everything." His mother shouts at him, "What is that your business?" And she turns back to the doctor and says, "He stopped doing his homework." Well, Lee, we are glad that you did not stop doing your homework and have written this elegant book on the history, meaning, and personalities behind the search for life among the stars. In the last 20 years, the field of exoplanets, the planets outside our solar system, has become the fastest growing branch of astronomy. 3,500 potential planets have been identified in a small patch in the Milky Way, and astronomers have concluded that there are roughly as many planets in the galaxy as stars, that is to say, billions, and some of them must be like ours. So I just want to read you one small passage from the book I just found so extraordinary. In September 2012, astronomers released a deep field image, a decade in the making, generated from 2 million seconds of Hubble observations. From time to time, they had pointed Hubble at what looked like a blank patch of sky, empty of any celestial object. That patch was small, with a field of view less than what you would get by gazing at the heavens through a soda straw. So just imagine, a soda straw. Hubble's scrutiny revealed thousands of far distant galaxies, not planets, not solar systems inside this little dot, but galaxies, like gems within the seeming void, yellow ellipticals, blue spirals, and jumbled irregulars, entangled skeins of color. This wonderful account is less about exoplanets and more about the people who make the search for them their lives' cause. As Lee says, they are creatures that before the sun went dim might somehow touch the stars. I give you Lee Billings.
Well, thank you, Tim, for the introduction. You stole my thunder with a few of those factoids there. You're gonna hear them again probably when I give them out. But it's great to be here tonight. I really appreciate everyone coming out. It means a lot. And it almost feels, it's an honor, I guess, to be here at the New York Society Library. It feels special. And I think maybe before we get any further, I should try to tell you a little bit about why it's special for us all to be here right now. A little bit of a warm fuzzies on this third rock from the sun. So let me begin by just congratulating all of you by the improbable achievement of your existing in the first place. Let's start there. If you think about it, most of this, pardon me, I have a little bit of a cold in the cough, so if I clear my throat, it's what it is. Most of the universe is, you know, empty space, and most of the the empty space, most of the stuff that's in that empty space, is in the form of dark energy and dark matter, things we know very, very, very little about. If you think about it, plopped in at random in this big space we call the universe, you're looking at about a 1 million odds that you're going to find yourself in a galaxy. 1 million. And even if you do end up in a galaxy, your chances of being on a planet around a star in a nice, clement orbit are very, very, very slim. So, you know, not good odds here. Now, most of the galaxy itself also is void, empty space. And it's got the average density, I think, someone told me once, of about one proton per cubic centimeter. So not a lot of stuff out there. And at any given time, only the slimmest fraction of all that material in the galaxy, all those protons, is condensed into anything as significant as a single hydrogen atom. So the rest is just nuclei and hot plasma. It's really quite a statistically unlikely achievement to be anything at all, whether that's a rock or a wisp of gas or a planet or a star or a person. So, you know, that's kind of a little bit of big picture perspective here. You could say that we're in a special place in the universe. You can also say that we're in a special time. Let's focus just on our planet now. Life seems to have sprung up here about 4.5 billion years ago, shortly after the planet formed. And in all that time, though, that entire 4.5 billion years, the Earth's never held anything like us, nothing that can write sonnets or poetry or make a, you know, paint a landscape or feel love or build a rocket. And we're kind of at this interesting point where chance and necessity through evolution has produced us that, you know, we have the power to kind of end the world if we want to, lots of different ways, or maybe even outlive it. What I want, you know, one thing to think about is that for more than 80% of the history of the world, essentially all life on Earth has only been single-celled microbes. And one more visceral way to kind of think about that, one of my favorite little analogies to use, is to stretch your hands out wide like this. And if you've ever read any John McPhee, he's the guy who came up with this, so it wasn't me. I love it, though. And this is all of earthly time. So the Earth forms at the tip of your left finger, and present day is right here at the tip of your right finger, your index finger, ring finger, whichever one's longer. That's all of time. And now, in all that time, basically everything from the tip of my finger, the formation of the planet, up to the wrist right here, that's just where nothing really happened on Earth. It was just single-celled life. All of complex life, so trilobites, dinosaurs, mass extinctions, mammals, all that, is in the palm of your right hand. And if you want, you can just wipe away all of human history with a little flick of a nail file. So that's kind of the big perspective. You know, we are in this little special moment of time, and as brief as it is, we already know it's not going to last forever. Obviously, it's not going to go into the future. The planet's going to end at some point. Well, when's that going to happen? This is a long, drawn-out way of me explaining what the title of the book is about. Astronomers used to think about 5 billion years from now, that would be the end of the world. That is when the sun's going to swell into a big red giant and scorch the Earth down to slag. Nothing will be able to live on the surface or even underneath the surface. It'll just be a little cinder. 5 billion years is how long we have left. Oh, wait. Planetary scientists said a little after that, it's not going to be 5 billion years in the future. It's more like 2 billion because stars get brighter as they age. Main sequence stars, those are burning hydrogen, they get brighter. So the sun will get bright enough in about 2 billion years to evaporate the oceans. So there's no water left on Earth, so there's no us, right? 2 billion years. About 30 years ago, a guy and some colleagues, the guy in the book that I talk about who did this is named Jim Casting. I won't talk much more about him in this presentation, but he's in the book. About 30 years ago, he realized that actually the end could come about 500 million years from now, 500 million years from now, which sounds like a long time, but that's like telling someone who's 45 years old they only have 5 years left to live. It's not that long. What's going to happen is the brightening sun I already mentioned, it's going to get bright enough to essentially throw the carbon cycle on our planet all out of whack. While this is going on, the Earth's interior will be getting cooler, so volcanism slows down, which replenishes the atmosphere. The carbon dioxide is getting sucked out of the atmosphere via rain, falling into rock. What ends up happening is the carbon dioxide drops to precipitous levels. There's barely any of it left. Well, carbon dioxide, which we talk about now as being this threat, this bad thing, 500 million years from now is going to be the most precious thing for the biosphere we can imagine. It's what keeps photosynthesis going. It's what allows the base of the food chain to exist. So carbon dioxide plummets in the atmosphere, the food chain collapses, we all die. We're still around. So we have to find at least 500 million years from now some other place to go. We've got plenty of time, but in the big scheme of things, not that much. So what that means is that 4.5 billion years of life in the past, we're about maybe 500 million years in the future. That gives you this nice round number, 5 billion years. And I'm kind of concerned that out of all this time, we're not gonna reach out and find other examples of Earth, even though we know they must be out there someplace. And that's one reason why I wrote the book. We're at the first point in this long history where we're suddenly finding and studying other worlds and getting a better grip on what's out there. And it's a valuable thing to look, even if we don't find another planet, because another planet like ours, because it's going to give us some context to our lives and this little small planetary speck of dust. You know, we don't know fully what's out there. It could be that habitable planets are a dime a dozen, that they're common as dirt, and around Alpha Centauri there's someone with green skin just like me giving the same conversation. It could be that we are the only living planet in the galaxy, or maybe the universe. We don't know. But we can go find out for the first time in the history of life on this planet, in that 4.5 billion year history. So that's what the book's really about. It's about the men and women who are making their life's purpose to do that, and what we'll do with that information when we get it, what we're going to do with our moment in the sun. So that's a long preamble about the book. We're now going to go into a little update about what we do know about what's out there right now. This is trying to tell you something that Tim already graciously mentioned, which is that we know now that planets are around essentially every star in the sky. Anytime you look at the star in the sky, you're looking at a planetary system. And that sounds really obvious, but that's new. We didn't know that for a long time. We've found more than 3,000. There's about on the order of 5,000 that we now know, if you take a few candidate planets, as probably being legitimate planets. And there's no sign that this is going to stop anytime soon. This has only happened in the last 20 years or so. I think it's fair to say that by the end of the decade, we're going to have at least 10,000 exoplanets that we know about to study and look at and gaze at and wonder about. And I like to call this the exoplanet boom, this explosion of discovery. And by the way, I think that 10,000 number is actually on the low side. I think it might be more like 20,000 or 3,000 or maybe 100,000. And it's revolutionizing astronomy. So this is the key boring graph. So there will be a few of these. I'll try to get everyone through it as fast as possible. This is the key information that's showing what I'm talking about, this exoplanet boom. What you're seeing here is actually most of the planets we now know plotted by a year of discovery here, and their mass up here on the y-axis. Each one of these dots is a planet. You'll notice the first one actually is back in 1989. That was something that they found. They didn't think it was a planet. It turned out to be a planet later. The big one that most people pay attention to is in 1995. These are very, by the way, this is right around here is the mass of Earth. So this line right here is about like Earth mass, right around here, more or less. This is a weird pulsar planet no one likes to talk about because it's so strange. 1995 is when the first big one happened. This is one, a hot Jupiter, it's called, around a star called 51 Pegasi. This is called 51 Pegasi b. It is a little less massive than Jupiter. It's in about like a 3 or 4 or 10 day orbit around its star, just whizzing around really crazily, super close in, very fast, very hot, not a good place to live. And most of the ones we found, obviously, at first are all like this. They're all these really heavy, strange things we didn't understand, and then something started happening. Our equipment got better and better and better. We got better at finding these things and looking for smaller and smaller ones. And you can just see that, you know, year by year, we're finding, you know, okay, there's one year. There's some years early on we just had these droughts. We don't find anything. And then these things start to happen. We find lots of planets each year, lots of planets each year. Around 2007, 2008, we just get these lines. All the planets blur into lines. You can't even tell how many we found because there's so many. And they span such a wide range of masses. Now, again, I mentioned around here is Earth. Look at this. So this is 2012 right here. We found a planet that is essentially just a little bit bigger than Earth. This should tell you something. This should tell you, obviously, we're on the cusp of finding Earths. and these little lines right here, again, over here, the ones that are just like walls of worlds, that's mostly due to this one mission you've probably heard about a little bit called Kepler, NASA's Kepler mission. Let's talk a little more about Kepler and what it's telling us. Kepler launched in 2009 on a 3.5 year mission. There's a little picture of it right here. This is where it's looking. Little swath of the Milky Way, about 150,000 stars, out to a distance of about 3,000 light years. Just a little tiny part of the Milky Way, not a big part of the Milky Way, a little tiny part. It was looking for Earth twins, so Earth-sized planets in year-long orbits around sun-like stars. That's the main thing it was looking for, but while it was looking, it also found thousands of other planets of all kinds, around all kinds of different stars. Told us a lot of interesting things. Kepler's primary mission, bless you, ended last year. But it's still doing some good science for us, but its glory days are over. And it's already told us super interesting things. So most notably, we used to think, maybe you've heard of this thing called the Copernican Principle by this guy named Copernicus, you know, back in like the 1500s or was it 1600s, said that, okay, you know, the Earth actually is not the center of the universe. The sun actually is the center of our solar system, and the Earth moves around the sun. People have been using that for hundreds of years since then to say that the Earth is mediocre and average and normal and not extraordinary in any way. But we're finding out that actually our planet and our whole solar system actually are pretty abnormal in some surprising ways. Kepler's done a lot of this research for us. So, for instance, most planetary systems that we found, and they seem to be very common, actually harbor several close-in orbiting planets well within the orbit of Mercury. So where we have nothing around our star, typically there's more like three or four planets packed down there around most stars. Pretty weird. We also know that about half of all planets seem to orbit binary stars. So we're talking about, you know, the average world out there may have a double sunset, like Tatooine in Star Wars, right? That's different than what we see here. So we're not necessarily super-duper crazy special, but we're certainly not average. We're certainly not normal. And that's interesting to think about, because it has implications for life out there, obviously. This is a breakdown of all the known exoplanets, mostly via Kepler. It's from February 2014. It's still pretty up to date. What I want you to notice is kind of the different categories of worlds we have here, and the numbers, obviously, on the side. The percentages is just showing how many Kepler announced in one day earlier this year. They announced, I think, something like 715 new planets in one day. This is an example of the boom I was talking about. But look at the categories. So Jupiter size, lots of those guys. We found lots of them because they're easy to find. They're so big. Neptune size, we found a bunch of those guys too. But here's where the interesting things happen. This number right here, these so-called super-Earths, these are things that are slightly bigger than Earth, up to maybe 10 times the mass of Earth, which would equate to about 2 times Earth radius. They're in between the mass of Earth and Neptune. These things are really strange, and they're everywhere out there. They seem to be the most common type of planet we find. We have no examples of super-Earths in our own solar system. No one really knows why that is. It's kind of strange. No one even predicted this population would exist. So there's a lot of theoretical work to figure out why this is like this and what it means. But the point is, again, that our system, our planet, is not typical. It's not average. It seems to be an outlier. We seem to be somewhat special against this Copernican theory. Now, the most important statistic of all is actually not something that's listed on this little graphic here, but I want to make sure you're not looking at the graphic and looking at me, because this is pretty incredible. Just take this home. The most important takeaway is that if you look at all these stars that Kepler's looked at, you know, all the stars it's looked at, you just look at the sun-like stars it's looked at, and then you look for planets around those stars, the sun-like stars, that seem to be about the size of Earth, give or take 10 or 20%, in a habitable orbit where it's not too hot, it's not too cold, it's just right for liquid water to conceivably exist on the planet's surface. You look at all those numbers out of that big statistical sample, and what you get is it looks like about 1 in 5 sun-like stars has an Earth-sized planet in its habitable zone. One in five. You do a little more math, that suggests that the nearest one to us is within a dozen light years. So pretty close. You don't need to go to another galaxy to find something that may be like Earth. It might be right next door. And you think about those kinds of numbers, and you think, well, hey, maybe we've already found Earth 2.0. Maybe it's already out there in the data. Maybe we know where it is. What you're seeing here is different kinds of stars and a kind of schematic drawing. I mentioned this habitable zone, the Goldilocks zone, the not too hot, not too cold zone, where it's just right for life and for liquid water. That's this band right here. Again, these are different star types. You can see the smaller the star is, the closer in the zone is, the bigger the star, the further out the zone is. Here's Earth right there. This is the sun. Here's obviously the other planets that are not in the habitable zone. You'll notice Mars here is kind of on the outer edge. That's why it's, you know, frigid and cold, not a good place to live. Venus right here, boiling, terrible place, right on the inner cusp. Earth's pretty close to the middle. So look at some of these other planets. Each one of these has made headlines over the past several years as a potential Earth 2.0. You know, X marks the spot where we need to send the rocket ships, right? They have names, you know, Kepler-62f, Kepler-62e, HD40307g. They don't roll off the tongue exactly. But you can look at these. I should have blown this up a little more. You can see, oh, look, it looks pretty nice, right? I mean, this one has, like, some oceans and clouds and continents on it, looks like. Look at these two right here. Gliese 581g looks like a nice place to live, I think. Gliese 581d. 581d doesn't look quite as nice. It looks more like Venus, but 581g looks pretty good. I mean, again, you can see these kind of hints of structure and clouds and continents. But those are artist renditions. So what do we really know about these planets, these potential Earths? Let's just focus again on these two right here, Gliese 581G and 581D. Let's find out what we really know. That's it. That's all we know about them. What this is, what you're seeing, so Gliese 581 is a star, red dwarf star, smaller and dimmer than our sun, about 20 light years away. It's got a bunch of planets around it. What you're looking, I'm going to explain how we find planets now for a little bit. So a little technical, but let's dive in together. Let's do this. The way that these planets have been found, what you're seeing here is actually the motion of the star as the planet whips around it in its orbit, and it tugs it back and forth. And we can detect that kind of wobble, that wobble of the star as the planet whips around it, bringing it closer to Earth and then further away from Earth. We can detect that as a slight change in motion. And you get this classical sine wave that tells you the period of the planet, the dip, the crest and the trough, that tells you the period of the planet, how long its year is. The amplitude, the size of the wave, is telling you, it's giving you an estimate of the mass, how big the planet is. That's all you really get from it. And again, this is kind of a classical symbol. So, nice clean symbol here. Here's the trouble. This is not either of the planets I just mentioned, the potentially habitable ones, Gliese 581 G, D. That's these things. This one is a Neptune-sized planet in an inhospitably hot, close-in orbit around the red dwarf star, Gliese 581. So the ones that are potentially habitable are these. They don't look nearly as clean, you might notice. The reason why is because of how delicate these measurements are. This one we're measuring is on the order of 10 meters per second. The star is wobbling back and forth 10 meters per second over the course of this planet's year. These, the potentially habitable ones, the ones that are smaller, are more on the order of like a meter per second. You could say five, but if you look at the spread, it's more like a meter per second. For a whole star we're measuring, 20 light years away, this big incandescent ball of roiling gas. Now, a meter per second, think about it. That's like this. That's like how fast I'm walking back and forth right now when we're doing this measurement. It's very delicate. It's amazing we can do it at all. But it's not that great in this case because I've actually fooled you. Just earlier this year, these two planets that made headlines, Gliese 581D and 581G, were basically shown to be not real. They're illusory. They don't exist. They're products of one of them is a product of abnormally stable magnetic fields on the star that mimicked a planet. It gets kind of complicated. But the point is, we're just barely looking for these very faint signals just cresting above these seas of stellar noise, and it's very tough measurement to make. We don't know a lot about these places. You wouldn't want to pack up a starship and go to these places because, as you see in this case, the planets disappear before you get there because they were mirages. So this is not Kepler. We were mentioning Kepler earlier. This is a different method called just think about it as wobbles, the wobbling stars. Let's talk about Kepler a little bit and what Kepler's found. This is the prize, kind of crown jewel of Kepler. This is a planet announced earlier this year. It's called Kepler 186f. Again, these great names. And in this case, there was a huge press conference, made front page news. In this case, it might have been justified. This thing is on the order of 500 light years away, orbiting another red dwarf star. And it's actually within the orbit of Mercury, if it would be in our own solar system. But again, this is a smaller, cooler star, so it's in the habitable zone. It's pretty close to where Earth would be in the habitable zone. It seems like it could have Earth-like temperatures. It's only slightly bigger than Earth. It's about 10% larger. So this could be an Earth. And again, look, right? Beautiful ice caps. You got little inlets. Is that like Hudson Bay or something right there? I mean, you could practically see, some highways or something, or city lights, it seems like. It looks like a great place to live. But what do we really know? You can see where this is going, I think, right? This is what we know about this planet. This is how Kepler finds planets. Kepler doesn't look for wobbles. Kepler looks for dips in starlight, the shadow that is cast when a planet just happens to cross in a rare geometric alignment, just cross the face of its star as seen from Earth. And you look at that little shadow, that little dip, and based on the depth of the shadow, you can estimate the planet's radius, its size. And the recurrence of the shadow gives you the planet's year again. So wobble gives you the mass estimate and the year, and then this thing called the transit method that Kepler uses gives you the size and the year. Now, you put size and mass together. What does that give you? I can see some smart folks in the audience. Is anybody? That's right, density. Gives you density. So this is an amazing thing. If what we can do for some of these Kepler planets, the ones that transit and give us this signal, we can find out their size. We can also get the wobble of their stars, and we can figure out if they're mostly made of rock or metal or ice or gas, water, things like that. Which, again, if you really think about it, is pretty amazing. We're doing this for these planets so far away. But, oh, and just one little factoid. An Earth around a sun seen from interstellar distances, transiting across it, is going to dim the sun's light more than this plastic cup is dimming the light that passes through it. So it's a really faint measurement to make when we're looking for Earths. It's kind of a random thing. But again, we don't know a lot about these planets. That's what I'm trying to hammer into your heads, that you know, you're seeing all these headlines about, oh, we found Earth 2.0, and you're thinking, well, why did I come here for this? This is boring. This guy is just like being a buzzkill. I am being a buzzkill. It's important. Here's why. This is a picture of Venus transiting the sun back in 2012, seen from space by a Japanese spacecraft, I think called Hinode. I probably pronounced that wrong. And it's really emblematic of where we are right now in exoplanet research because, you know, you can see some hints of structure here, maybe some clouds or something, but it's really, you're just seeing the planets there. You don't know what it's like. And you have to remember for a long time, up to the 1950s, great learned men, and women too, the best astronomers in the world thought that maybe Venus is a wonderful place to live because it's a little closer to the sun, but it's covered in clouds. The clouds can actually act like a shield. They reflect off all that starlight. So actually, less starlight gets to the surface of Venus than Earth. So you'd think maybe it's a nice place to live. People imagine flying men in carboniferous jungles and dinosaurs walking around in there. Of course, what ended up happening is we sent probes and saw microwaves pouring off the surface, found out that it's got a crushing CO2 atmosphere, hot enough to melt lead, terrible place to live, probably the worst place to live in the solar system. So we were fooled by this planet that's literally right next door, almost the exact same mass of Earth, in a habitable orbit. We were totally fooled. This could happen again. We've been fooled before. We will be fooled again. But again, you know, so this is before Matthew McConaughey goes to the wormhole, you know, he might end up being at one of these places, and that's terrible. You don't want to be there. We need to really characterize these things, figure out what their environments are really like before we decide to go anywhere or get excited about anything. Now, how could we do that, though? How are we going to figure out what the environment is like on these planets? Well, this image is emblematic for another reason. It's not just all bad news. This is where the cool stuff starts, guys. This is where the future comes in. What you're seeing here is starlight blasting through the upper atmosphere of Venus. You can see this little kind of this ring of light, sunlight blasting through the upper atmosphere. Now, one of the beautiful things about our world, our universe, one of the magical things about science is that light, whenever it interacts with matter, atoms, chemicals, things like that, the matter, the chemicals imprint their signatures on the light, spectroscopy. Essentially, you get the light that's, you know, bounced off this or gone through gas or whatever, and you split it into a spectrum, and there will be these little kind of dips and shadows in it, essentially, from where the substance that it interacted with absorbed certain frequencies of light. So you can figure out, you know, the fingerprint of whatever the light is interacting with. You can figure out what stuff's made of, even though it's around another galaxy or around another star. You could do that for Venus. For Venus, if you did that with that little faint ring of light right here, you'd figure out that, oh, look, there's lots of carbon dioxide, there's no water vapor. It's probably a terrible place to live. It's probably in a runaway greenhouse state. We don't want to go there. We've already done this for planets around other stars, mostly big, massive, puffy, hot Jupiter planets. And this only works when they transit, when they cross across the face of their stars again and cast a shadow towards Earth. We get that little ring of starlight, which we just see as like a little faint dip. It's really a very tough measurement to make, but we've already detected things like sodium and potassium. And actually, earlier this year, Hubble, I think, detected water vapor this way around kind of a Neptune-mass planet. Nothing to get too excited about. It's a terrible place to live, too. But hey, water vapor. Point is, we could do this with the right kind of space telescope for small, potentially habitable planets, not just these big, bloated balls of gas. But how could we actually do that? Well, first of all, NASA, to its credit, has funded and is building a satellite called TESS, the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite. It's supposed to launch in 2017. That will detect a lot of these transiting planets around nearby stars. We can't do this measurement, by the way, for Kepler's stuff, because, you know, Kepler found a great haul of planets, thousands of planets. We can't really do this for Kepler's stars, though, to Kepler's planets, because most of them are way, way, way too far away, even though they're very close to us in the galaxy. They're way too far away for us to do it. So we need to find planets that transit around the nearest, closest, brightest stars in the sky. And this NASA satellite called TESS will do that. There's also another European satellite called PLATO that will do that as well. That's launching in 2024. But they're just going to find the targets. What you need to actually gather the light, to get that ring of starlight, to get the atmospheric data, is something like this. This is the James Webb Space Telescope, or mock-up of it, scale model. You can see how big it is. It's actually, this gray thing is a sun shield. That's about the size of a singles tennis court. All these golden hexagons are its primary mirror. That's 6.5 meters wide. This thing's huge. They're going to pack it in a rocket, fold it up like a piece of origami, blast it out beyond the moon. It's going to get down to cryogenic temperatures in space, and it's going to be able to do this for a handful of potentially habitable planets around nearby stars that happen to transit and give us that ring of light for their atmosphere. NASA is kind of betting the farm on James Webb, and they're saying, a lot of people like to say right now that, oh, James Webb is going to find life, and this is the key. This is the key to us knowing whether or not we're alone. That's, I shouldn't say a bad word, that's nonsense, okay? And a lot this is very controversial. I mean, if this ends up going online, I hope that maybe someone from NASA sees this and gets mad at me, but it's nonsense, okay? This thing is about, I think, on the order of, how much is it now? $9 billion? It's supposed to launch in 2018. You can see why it's being promoted so much, because it's the biggest, you know, the biggest, best thing we've got going up there anytime soon. But it's not good enough. It's not good enough to get us what we need to know. What do we need to know? What do we want to know? We want to know about other Earths. We want to know whether or not places are habitable, like ours, like our planet. This, it could potentially do it for these big, slightly puffy super Earths that are around very, very dim stars, the red dwarf stars that are very close by. It could do that, but it's only going to do it for a handful. and this has to do with geometry. Basically, it's you think about the transit thing I mentioned, the shadows being cast towards Earth. It's a very rare geometric alignment. You know, what are the chances something's just going to pass just like that in front of your vision? Most of the time, it'll pass up here, down here, right? You won't see it. So it can only sample a very, very small number of stars. That's dangerous, because what happens if you look at five stars, five of these planets that might be habitable, and you don't see anything interesting? You don't really know what you've learned. You only looked at five of them. Out of hundreds of billions, out of trillions probably. So what you need to do to actually figure out what you're learning is to look at tens or hundreds or even thousands of these potentially habitable planets. But you can't really do that with this, and you can't really do it just with this little transit method looking for this ring of light that is all based on pure luck, geometric alignment. So what are we going to do? Well, this is what I think we need to do, and this is what, again, I hope people from NASA pay attention. NASA already knows this. They're just scared to say it because it's going to cost a lot of money. What you're looking at here is a star called Fomalhaut, about 25 light years away. This is an image from the Hubble Space Telescope. This is a big debris disk around the star. This is the star where the star would be, but all its light has been, or most of its light has been nulled out, swept away, blocked by an occulter in the scope, just a little tiny dot, essentially, that's covering it up and blocking it so it doesn't get into the optics of the system. And you can see here this little tiny shape moving through what looks to be a so-called Keplerian orbit. This thing seems to be circling the star. This seems to be an image of a planet. Now, it doesn't look that impressive, but let's give you a little bit of perspective. This thing is probably about the size of Jupiter or maybe Saturn with rings. It could be a little smaller. Like, it could be actually be not a planet at all, but we're two big kind of ice giant Neptune-like things collided together around this star and blew up into a big cloud that we're seeing. But the point is this is probably a planet. It's about four times further out than Pluto. So it's really, really, really far out there, even though it looks so close, and it's really big. So anything that we're looking for, anything that we want to directly image, as this technique is called, take a picture of, to get its actual, you know, figure out what it's like there, look, get an image of it and look at its atmosphere, things like that, it's going to be right down there, just hugging the star. People like to say that it's kind of equivalent to trying to discern a firefly against the world's brightest spotlight, maybe about an inch away from it, when you're in New York and the spotlight and the firefly are in Los Angeles. Or, you know, another way is that you're in New York and then instead of a firefly and a spotlight, it's a huge thermonuclear explosion, which is what a star is, basically, a controlled thermonuclear explosion, and there's an unlit match just right on the cusp of it. That's the contrast ratio that we're dealing with. We have to sweep out about 10 billion photons of starlight to get one photon of light from the planet and then build up an image that way. For perspective, that's kind of like saying you have to go meet every single person on the planet and shake their hand, and you're only interested in finding one of them. It's kind of like that. But we can do this. That's what's so amazing, is that as crazy as this sounds, we can actually do it. All it really takes is a very, very big mirror in space, a very big light-gathering surface, because we figured out how to actually achieve these starlight suppression ratios of 10 billion to 1. We've done that in the lab. That's been done. So we just need to build a big mirror and put it in space. How big? Well, this is where everyone blanches and gets scared. Here's Hubble, revolutionized astronomy. Here's James Webb. It's going to revolutionize astronomy when it launches in 2018, provided the rocket doesn't blow up. These things, this is 8 meters, that's 16 meters. You can tell by their abbreviation, the at last concept, that astronomers have been thinking about this for a very long time. They're much bigger. It's hard to imagine these things going up in space, how they'd fit within a rocket. But it's not impossible. That people have done studies. This one right here would deliver tens, maybe even hundreds of portraits of planetary systems around nearby stars. So not just Earths, but whole portraits, family portraits of all the planets around the stars. You could look at their, I'll get into what you could look at in just one second. This one right here could give you thousands of planetary portraits. So all the, you know, thousands of nearby stars, you're going to be able to figure out what's orbiting all of them, what the planets are like, and you can actually look for other Earths and other life. And that's our best chance, I think, of ever finding whether or not we're alone. Here's the trouble. For several years in the 2000s, when the exoplanet boom was just getting started, NASA was on board with this and very excited about this. And they were spending to the tune of $50 million a year making this happen. Was it $500 million? the point is that one of these things is going to cost several billion dollars, which is a lot of money, a lot of cheddar. It's not chump change, even for NASA. But, you know, in the big scheme of things, it's equivalent to a month or two of war in the Middle East. It's we actually leave, apparently. I read the statistic. I don't know if it's true. I've read it on the internet, so maybe it's not real. But apparently we leave more unspent money on gift cards each year than it would cost to build one of these. So we could do it. We could do it. But it's not looking like it's going to happen anytime soon. I mentioned they were working on it in the early 2000s. In 2006, NASA decided to put these programs on hold, defer them indefinitely, to launch a few more space shuttles and to help the James Webb Space Telescope out. The first one was supposed to launch, they were called Terrestrial Planet Finders. The first one was supposed to actually launch this year, in 2014. And that was going to be followed by another one that was more ambitious in 2020. So the planets are just piling up in the meantime, and the kind of the great era of discovery has been deferred, and I fear now that we're not going to live to see it, any of us. But maybe things will change. Maybe we'll decide that this is worth doing. Again, not that much money in the big scheme of things. That's why I wrote the book. This is what you get. This is what happens if you actually invest. Now, it doesn't look like much. Let me tell you what this is. You've probably seen this before. You probably know what this is. This is a picture of the Earth taken from beyond the orbit of Pluto by the Voyager 1 spacecraft back in 1991 or 1990 as it departed the solar system. Obviously, Earth doesn't have a big blue ring around it. I doctored it there. It's in a sunbeam, pale blue dot, Carl Sagan liked to call it. This is a rough approximation of what you would actually see of a living planet from light years away, another Earth around another star. And again, doesn't look like much, but you can data mine this thing for amazing, amazing stuff. For instance, if you see this little dot over time, monitor it over time, you can gradually see that, hey, it's getting dark and then it's getting light again. It's getting dark and getting light again. And that's because as you're watching it rotate underneath you, if the geometry is favorable, you're seeing things like dark light absorbing oceans and bright light reflecting continents rotate into view. You can actually map that over time. Once you pin down the rotation rate, you know the same things coming underneath you time and time and time again. You can figure out through the different brightnesses, even things like, you know, what's ice, what's sand, maybe what's forest, or something like chlorophyll that seems to be absorbing certain wavelengths of light to feed on. If you manage to get a spectrum, that's this thing that gives you atmospheric information, just from this little pale blue dot, you can see things, and we've done this for the Earth, by the way. You can see things like methane or oxygen, water vapor. Methane and oxygen are the holy grail that people want to find in an atmospheric spectrum of a planet, and that's because these things don't like to coexist together. Here on Earth, oxygen makes about 21% of our atmosphere by volume, but oxygen doesn't want to stay in the air, if you think about it. That's what rust is. Oxygen wants to fall out of the air and bond with rocks and anything else. So it's this thing that doesn't want to linger around. So the fact that we have so much of it in our atmosphere suggests that something's replenishing it. That something here is life. It's photosynthesis. Methane's the same way. Methane, if you put it in a box at room temperature and pressure with oxygen, it's going to turn into water vapor and carbon dioxide. The methane goes away, the oxygen goes away too. Methane here comes mostly from bacteria that live in cow guts and rice paddies and things like that. And so when you see these two things together, oxygen and methane, that's really telling you, for the Earth at least, that is literally the breath of life that you're seeing from across, from very far away. And we could see that same thing for another planet or another star. Now, what happens after we get that measurement? I don't know, or if we ever will get the measurement, but it's possible. We know how to do it. And I think it would lead to great things, and it would let us know maybe that we're not alone. So that's kind of what this is really about. That's the big picture, and that's the kind of update on where this field needs to go, and I'll leave it to your questions now. Please tell me those questions. Yes.
You seem to be looking just for Earth-like planets out there, and therefore, and you just suggested or indicated that you definitely need oxygen and methane, all right? But obviously, we're just an accident of evolution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. Does everyone hear the question? Why are we assuming that Earth is the standard, or that Earth life is the standard? Well, we're forced to do that, basically because we don't know anything. All we know is what's here. We have a sample size of one for what life is like and for a planet that life got started on. And it's a chicken and egg problem, because to find out the limits of life on planets, you need to find an example of it, another example, and have a bigger sample size than just one. To get a bigger sample size than just one, you really need to know the limits of life on planets and what kinds of planets they can exist on. So it's a vicious circle. That said, there's really good thermodynamic and chemical and physical arguments for why things like carbon are really good as a backbone for life, and why water is a natural solvent. And if you have carbon-based life in a watery environment on a rocky planet like Earth, there's very good reasons, I think, and a lot of people would agree with me, and some people would disagree, there's good reasons to think that that essentially, well, basically what it comes down to is that regardless of your chemistry, regardless of, carbon, water, rocky planet, we take those things as a given. There's very, very good reasons to think that oxygen is still a good signature to look for, because no matter what your DNA is or whatever your replicating molecules are, or if you're made of proteins or whatever, there's still a thermodynamically favorable reaction in that environment that will net free energy for you to use to build your body and drive a metabolism that will vent off oxygen through splitting water. That's kind of complicated. We can talk more about it actually offline if you want. But all I'm trying to say is just like, you know, we have to start from what we know. There's quite probably other kinds of life out there, strange life, but we don't know how to look for it very well. So that's all it is. Well, so they still have very similar biochemistry. They're still made of DNA. They're still carbon-based. They still, you know, they replicate with DNA or RNA. So they're still, I mean, they're related to us. They aren't really aliens. The trouble with a lot of that stuff, because I think what you're getting at there is, well, why would we need to look for something like Earth when we found these bacteria that can exist in, like, practically boiling water, or, you know, down in the center of a planet, right, or in the middle of a nuclear reactor, for instance. Those are all real bacteria we know of. The reason why is because they don't make strong signals for us to see across the light years. So even though there may be so-called cryptic biospheres on Mars, right next door, Mars could have bacteria on it right now, deep down in the crust, or not deep down, but you know, below the ground. That's very feasible to think about. But you can see how much trouble we're having finding it there. And we've got an SUV, a mini SUV driving around there. So when it's around another star, it's a tough measurement to make. Doesn't mean they're not there. It just means we're not going to be able to see them anytime soon with our current technology.
Just as well, I had read somewhere that someone cautioned people, what is the big hot race to find other life when it could end up being quite dangerous to us? What do you thought about that?
Well, I think it... the question is, what's the big hot race to find alien life if it could be very dangerous to us? And that's a good question. There's a lot of gradations to it, right? Because we find life on Mars, it's close by, for instance. If it's a little microbe, I don't know if we should be that scared of it, because if it arose totally independently of us, it means it probably doesn't use DNA. It probably has very different biochemistry than us, even though it's still, you know, probably carbon and water-based, as far as we would know. So it's not, you know, it's not going to latch onto our cells probably and be able to infect us. In the same way that, like, I can't give my dog a cold, and we're super duper related, and we spend a lot of time together, and it licks my face all the time, you know. But it's not going to give me a cold most of the time. you know, we there's some instances, you know, pigs can give us cold and avian flu and things like that, but these are very, our closest ancestors. So I think that the possibility of some kind of Andromeda strain-like scenario, even for things in the solar system, is pretty remote. Granted, we don't know, and NASA actually has a full-time planetary protection officer who thinks about that full-time. So, I mean, you know, people are definitely watching out for it. If it's around another star, that's a different question. The issue there is, can it get to us to harm us in any way? And if it's a microbe, I don't think so. If it's something that has, you know, ray guns and warp drives, that would be pretty scary. But there's, you know, there's another take on this, too, which is that some people could actually say that if we find life on Mars, for instance, it is super scary. But it's not scary because of what it will do to us. It's scary because it portends very bad things for our future. The way that works is that if we find independent life that arose independently on Mars, right next door, and again, it's independent, it's not DNA-based, that would suggest that life is ubiquitous throughout the universe, that life forms literally anywhere it can. That's what it would suggest to me, again, if it wasn't based on DNA. But if you think that through, if life is everywhere out there, why is it so deathly quiet? Why don't we see anybody? And I think the greater the chances are of life forming everywhere and not being rare and being normal, the worse our future looks in terms of all the things we'd like to think we're going to go do. You know, Captain Kirk in the Enterprise or Luke Skywalker destroying the Death Star, going out and exploring the galaxy. I don't think any of that stuff will necessarily happen unless we try, and maybe it's just not possible. I like to think it's possible, but who knows?
And forget the ones that are 500
years away. Right, right.
You'll never have a conversation with
them. Well, you know, and that's a good point. So, the question. Right. So, did you hear the question?
Well, it's sorry. Phil was talking about the fear of alien life forms. And, you know, maybe Mars has microbes, we're not sure.
Right. Yeah, the problem of traveling between the stars is what we're talking about. I think you're probably right. You know, back in the days when the internet was slow, when they had modems, you know, people would say, "Well, never underestimate the bandwidth of a truck filled with, you know, CDs in the back." And I think that could be true in an interstellar case too. Broadcasting, I don't think, is necessarily the way to go, even though I think it's probably the safest and soundest. But that's we're kind of getting into ephemera. I think the value of this is something I referred to earlier. So talking about the Copernican principle, this notion that we're not special, that we're just average and ordinary, and how increasingly we're getting data that suggests that's not true, you know, people, again, have thought for a long time, we're going to look around every star, there will be an Earth there. And we know that's not true now already, but we don't know the extent to how not true that is. We don't know the extent to how special we might be. And we're never going to fully know, I don't think. But, you know, imagine we built one of these big space telescopes, and everyone thinks, oh, you know, we've spent X number of billion dollars to put this huge thing in space and survey the nearest 500 or 1,000 stars, and, oh, we better find something. What if we find nothing at all? What if we look around all the 500 or 1,000 stars and we find no planet that really closely resembles our own and the most important characteristics we care about? We find no signs of life. Maybe we're looking in the wrong way. Or maybe it's actually really important and special that we're here right now, which would go against hundreds of years of orthodoxy in science. So, you know, again, if you think about it on the biggest scales, I'm not saying we're meaningful. I don't think we matter on the scale of galaxies and superclusters. But Maybe just for the Milky Way. Maybe we're kind of a little significant. I don't know.
The Milky Way is a relatively insignificant galaxy.
Of course. Yeah. Right, on the biggest scales, I'm not...
And you would say 500,000. Big number, but it's really a tiny number.
Yeah.
And if the green version of you, 100 million light years out there, is making the same speech,
we'll never find them in that case.
They're special, and they'll worry when they think they're special. And if they look at a million stars and find no sign of life, well, what conclusion can you draw?
Well, again, at the Well, I agree with you. I think on larger scales, it's pretty tough to make the argument that we're significant. Again, it's just if maybe in the 500 or 1,000 light year bubble around the planet, maybe we're special. That's a pretty big portion of space for my druthers. So I'd be happy with that. But I'm on your wavelength.
Can you talk a little bit about how you gather the data to write the book?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm not a scientist. I'm just a camp follower. I'm just someone who you know, couldn't do it in science myself, couldn't hack it. It would be a bench worker at best. And then I realized I could go write about the rock stars by trying to tell their stories. And what's beautiful about scientists, unlike captains of industry or celebrities, most celebrities, is that they really want to talk to you. They really actually want to talk to the media to tell their story because they believe so passionately in what they're doing. And I think most of the time, not always, it's a relatively pure and uncorrupted desire. And so consequently, you can go and be a student. If you say, hey, I want to write about your cool quest to find planets, tell me about it. Tell me how that works. Tell me about your life. And they just open up. So that's what it was. I spent a lot of time visiting with some of the leaders in the field. I found those leaders in the field through reading a lot of papers, a lot of books, talking to a lot of different people, and kind of and also, frankly, people who would talk to me. So, for instance, there's a lot of great planet hunters who only speak French, which I do not speak. So they are not in the book in a lot of ways, unfortunately. It's definitely focused on America, but that's how it happened, just spending a lot of time with them. Yes, please.
I remember from Cornell, the great scientists up there talking about the billions and billions and billions of galaxies, and each one having billions and billions and billions of stars. And just from those figures, you know that we can't be unique, and there's bound to be, at least I always believe, bound to be lots and lots and lots of things similar to Earth with life of some form. And yet, it wasn't more than 2 months ago that somebody was being interviewed, I think on an NPR channel, talking about the unlikelihood of there being other life on other life. What is the argument that says it's unlikely?
The argument that says that life is unlikely in the universe? If there's one thing that the book doesn't talk about, it is the probability of life starting elsewhere. Because I want to say I'm kind of a Saganist, if I could use that word. If Sagan can inspire a whole generation of people to think a certain way, and I think that life is something that just happens in the universe, like stars or galaxies or planets. And the same way that we actually don't fully understand how planets form right now, I think you could say life is like that, except a lot more complicated. But the argument essentially for why life might be really rare is that it might be complex life in particular, is that it's contingent upon so many different chance occurrences, so many coincidences, it seems. So, for instance, the Earth was hit by a great impactor about the size of Mars early after it formed. That's what gave us our moon. The moon is how we have powerful tides. The tides are much more powerful early in the planet's life because the moon is much closer in. It's been slowly spiraling out. You have to wonder. This is also the same time that life seems to have arisen on our planet, single-celled life. People think about things like Darwin's, what did he call it? Like a tiny little pond or the primordial soup, little tide pools, essentially, that can be little reservoirs of chemical activity and you get diversity, chemical diversity and chemical evolution through all the different little tide pools you have. Well, what if you don't really have strong tides from a moon? The moon is just one example. There's hundreds of examples that we can think of, and there's probably a lot more that are, you know, that we could imagine or that we could potentially find out there just for our planet and just for life here and us being here. So I think that's basically, you know, it's the how many little eyes of the needle can this process of developing complex life pass through before it becomes so improbable that it's a miracle? And that's the argument against, I think, life being out there. But no one really knows, so I'm not really on either side. Thanks so much, guys. I really appreciate it. And I'll be signing books out here if you want.